What does it mean to receive an Alzheimer's diagnosis in South Dakota? From SDPB, today is Monday, May 5th. This is In the Moment. Today on the program, we spend the hour talking about matters of the mind. A new independent lens film tells the story of families across the country on their own Alzheimer's journeys. We wanted to know what it's like to live with Alzheimer's here at home. The In the Moment team gathered a studio audience and a panel of experts. Today, we bring that conversation to the far corners of South Dakota. We will talk about the benefits of early diagnosis. We'll explore the latest research into treatments that may slow the progression of the disease and increase quality of life. And we'll look at how to navigate the Alzheimer's journey with support, compassion, and dignity. We are broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment, and news is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. A new independent lens film premieres on SDPB tonight. It's called Matter of Mind, My Alzheimer's. The film follows three families confronting the unique challenges of the disease. Alzheimer's is a progressive neurodegenerative disease. It transforms relationships. In the film, we get to know two children who have become caregivers for their parents and a woman caring for her beloved partner. Well, we wanted to know more about Alzheimer's in South Dakota. So In the Moment hosted a live recording of our show with a studio audience. Together, we watched a preview of the independent lens film, and then we gathered a panel of local Alzheimer's experts around the table to share an intimate look into the research, treatment, resources, and care being offered in our state. We have Leslie Morrow as the State Executive Director of the South Dakota Alzheimer's Association. We have Lisa Gruen, who is a dementia care consultant and a caregiver who is going to share some of her personal story with us tonight. Dr. Ahmed Abdelazim. Dr. Abdelazim is a neurologist at Sanford Health, and Dr. Alicia Hemraj is a geriatrician and internal medicine provider at Sanford Health. Thank you all so much for being here. And we have together watched a little bit of this independent lens documentary about Alzheimer's, which airs on SDPB TV tonight. But Dr. Hemraj, maybe we could start with you and help us understand what exactly is happening in the brain with Alzheimer's.
Certainly. Well, as we know, dementia is very prevalent, and particularly Alzheimer's disease is the most common type of dementia. It primarily affects those who are over the age of 65, and its cause, unfortunately, is unknown, and its pathophysiology is very, very complex. The most important or earliest manifestation of Alzheimer's disease is memory impairment. And oftentimes, this memory impairment is associated with another cognitive impairment, and that it could include language, it could include deficits in visual spatial, word-finding difficulties. And these impairments, in turn, affect one's ability to function. And so that function may include some basic tasks like brushing one's teeth, dressing, clothing, feeding, or some more intricate tasks like instrumental activities of daily living, which include more higher level of thinking tasks such as driving, finances, making your way to a doctor's appointment, taking your medications. So you can see that it affects, or can affect, a whole gamut of one's ability to function on a day-to-day basis.
What are the first, like, screenings? We all know how to screen for breast cancer or colon cancer. Are there screenings that are recommended?
Certainly. So I think first and foremost, if one has concerns about memory, they should visit their primary care doctor, and obtaining a very detailed history along with a good neurological examination is the hallmark, or is paramount rather, in identifying problems. And in turn, identifying further areas of cognitive impairment through neuropsychological testing also offers some great information. And one may also consider neuroimaging, such as MRI of the brain, which could identify some areas, especially in those involved in memory, such as the hippocampus and shrinking of that area. But what's new and exciting in the last couple of years are blood biomarkers. And so these blood biomarkers include amyloid protein and another type of protein called presenilin or tau. And so these blood tests can be ordered by your primary care doctor. And it's actually often said that if we include these blood biomarkers in the diagnostic testing, that Alzheimer's disease will be identified 90% of the time, which is remarkable.
So do you have to qualify for that blood test? Is that insurance? Is it very expensive? What are some of the obstacles to finding out that information?
So I don't know the exact answer for that, but I do know that these tests are becoming more mainstream. And so simply speaking with your doctor about obtaining some of these tests is a good start, and then working through the insurance company.
Leslie, tell me a little bit about how we have some new numbers on statistics and how many people in South Dakota are impacted. Give us some of the key highlights from that statistical report.
Sure. So 16,500 people in South Dakota over the age of 65 that are currently living with Alzheimer's disease. These are numbers that were just released on Tuesday, but that doesn't take into account those that are under the age of 65 who have another form of dementia besides Alzheimer's, and of course the undiagnosed. And we probably know folks in the community who are living without a diagnosis as well. So we believe that number to be even higher, unfortunately, in South Dakota than that 16,500 people. You know, as well as 27,000 unpaid caregivers in this state who are friends and family providing that care. That's not counting the folks who are in our long-term care facilities. And as you saw, even since these numbers just came out, as a nation, we're now over 7 million people. That's a new, unfortunate benchmark that we're at, 7.2 million people with the disease. And again, if we were to quantify the billions of hours that you saw that those caregivers put in, I mean, it's the number that I saw earlier this week that it was three times the entire amount that McDonald's made in 2023. I mean, that's an astronomical number. So the care those caregivers are providing at no cost, we can't even frankly calculate it, what they're doing.
And for people who haven't seen the full program yet, throughout the hour as we follow these families, their situations, well, I mean, we see the love and the warmth and the humor that they share with each other at first, and then there are real moments of stress where these caregivers, in spite of their devotion and their skill, frankly, are overwhelmed with their ability to handle what is coming up for them next. And that is a big tension as the film goes on. Lisa, tell me a little bit about your mom and some of how you first found out that this was going to be an Alzheimer's journey that you were on as well.
Yeah, certainly. So my mom was diagnosed when she was 65. My sister actually started seeing some early symptoms when she was about 64. And luckily, my sister works at Mayo Clinic, and so we were able to get my mom in for an assessment very quickly, which is often not the case for most folks. We were seeing things like she was supposed to take my kids to the Harrisburg Days Parade and couldn't find the start. She couldn't figure out where to meet us. That was odd. She couldn't find her way back to my house. She would say things where the word wasn't quite right. She would call a table a board instead of a table. You know, all harmless things. We didn't really see any damage or concern. We just noticed that something was off, and we got her an assessment real quick, and she was able to join a study and participate in some research in her early years before she moved into care.
How was she, what was that first conversation like? What was she say? Did she notice there was an issue too?
My mom never once acknowledged that she had Alzheimer's disease to the end of her life. We were able to learn about her goals of care and her interests through roundabout conversations. So we would say things like, we'd see something on the news and we'd say, oh gosh, I don't know if I'd want a ventilator. What do you think, Mom? Okay, then she'd give us answers, but she never acknowledged that she had Alzheimer's or that she was forgetting things. Even when she was in memory care, she would offer to babysit my kids.
Really?
And so we would say, yeah, sure. Let me look at the calendar.
Yeah. So you were constantly, what's your mom's name again?
Sue.
Sue. So you were constantly meeting her where she was at.
That was the main effort from day one. Mm-hmm. We our family read the book, Creating Moments of Joy. And every interaction we had with her, we tried real hard to do just that. And many times it was really about creating moments of dignity as well, and making sure that, you know, my mom cared very much about clean teeth and looking good and, you know, going to church. And so we made every effort to make those things possible for her.
Leslie, Lisa said this isn't necessarily the most common story to have the early screening and early diagnosis. What are you seeing in your work is, you know, the gamut of when people come to a diagnosis?
You know, unfortunately, there are a lot of things at play, and probably the physicians can attest to it, that first of all, we have a very rural state, so sometimes just the neighborhood you live in can be a barrier to healthcare. Many are driving hours to come to Sioux Falls or to the other side of the state, to Rapid City, to try and get some clarity on their condition. I think we talk about folks primarily being over the age of 65, but those younger onset cases prior to age 65, that diagnosis tends to be more difficult because there are so many other things. It's getting better, but I think for a while it didn't occur to folks to test for Alzheimer's disease when they're 39, 42, 48 years old. And so that could be a barrier as well. And, you know, I think sometimes, you know, physicians themselves are healers, and to have to diagnose a disease that currently has no cure can be hard for physicians, and I'm stepping carefully, but I think sometimes it can be difficult for folks to give that diagnosis. We've seen examples, particularly in smaller towns, when they've known their patient the entire life, and now they have to hand out a diagnosis that, you know, I do think that's changing a lot, but it has happened where we have had cases where people, their physician was hesitant to give the diagnosis, and they've sought second opinions and then received that diagnosis. Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit, Dr. Al-Azim, about research and some of the new things that we're trying to. I was surprised when Dr. Hemraj said, we don't really know what causes this. What? How do we not know that? So help us get a big picture of the research, what we know and what we don't know.
Definitely. Exactly. Alzheimer's disease, unfortunately, it has no definitive cure. So really the focus on is to diagnose it early on and, you know, start treatments that can slow down this disease progression. There are breakthrough research, like Dr. Hemmer said, that focus on blood-based biomarkers, which basically is a simple blood test that can be sent, and if it is positive, it can be positive actually several years before Alzheimer's symptoms can show up, which can provide opportunity for early, you know, treatment that can slow down this disease progression. This is certainly an area of research that is now growing and actually is going to be everywhere in the country for Alzheimer's patients to get that early diagnosis. Other areas of research basically focus on early treatment that can slow down the disease progression. For example, the anti-amyloid therapy. Lecanemab, for example, is a treatment that, if given to qualified patients, can slow down the disease progression. Okay, it is not going to cure it, but at least it's going to delay the progression for Alzheimer's disease. More interestingly, there are studies now showing that lifestyle changes can actually, you know, slow down the disease progression and even, you know, ease the symptoms. For example, physical exercise, nutrition, appropriate sleep, and vascular risk factor control, like blood pressure control. I would say physical exercise and blood pressure control would be the key two components to help delay or slow down neurodegenerative conditions in general.
Is it that if you have this, you're always going to get it? I mean, is it like, do you know at birth? Does it happen at a certain age? Help us understand how the disease progresses and if it can, is there an off ramp?
Unfortunately, it is hard to predict when it is going to happen. And basically, we usually see neurodegenerative disorders such as Alzheimer's disease showing up at older age, by the age of 65 or more. There is few percentage, I would say maybe less than 1%, that is related to genetic factors and familial components. But this is something known to run in the family. But usually it's hard to predict which person is going to get Alzheimer's disease unless they start showing symptoms. Like Dr. Hemmer said, the very first symptoms would be memory impairment for recent events, for example.
More with our panel after the break. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Let's get back to our panel on Alzheimer's in South Dakota. I'm joined by Lisa Gruen, dementia care consultant and caregiver, Leslie Morrow, state executive director of the South Dakota Alzheimer's Association, Dr. Alicia Hemraj, she's a geriatrician and internal medicine provider at Sanford Health, and Dr. Ahmed Abdelazim. He is a neurologist at Sanford Health. We recorded this conversation with a studio audience in our Leo P. Flynn Gallery in the SDPB studios in Sioux Falls.
Dr. Hemraj, when do you know it's regular memory stress? You know, I'm overwhelmed, I have too much going on, and when do you know it's significant?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that I failed to mention earlier as far as diagnosing is concerned is, you know, your informant, your partner, your caregiver might pick up on signs sooner than you do. And it's important to involve these people in the communication with a primary care doctor when they're there to share their impairment. It's important to include the informant there because the individual may underestimate or overestimate their memory impairment. And so having an informant there to provide a little bit more context is so important.
So we see in the film, Matter of Mind, some of these doctor's appointments. And it was interesting to me to see how the doctor had those conversations. So walk us through, if I'm here and my caregiver is with me, you're talking about me, but how do you navigate the communication as a doctor to make sure the patient feels like they're the one that's fully in the room, but you're getting the information that you need, and that the caregiver feels heard?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a tricky situation. It's not easy. But certainly, I think my focus in my own practice is always my patient first. You know, talking to my patients, extracting what they feel is important to them or what they're struggling with. And then also kind of turning to them and asking them who they trust, you know, with their personal information and their health decision making. And so oftentimes, the person that is with them is someone that they can trust in sharing information that ultimately will help them deal with what they're going through. So I think that's part of it.
Yeah. Lisa, as you went on the journey, when did you know that you needed outside assistance in caregiving? Beyond, you know, going to the doctor or getting medication or what have you, but when did you say, like, this is something that we need help with caregiving?
Right. When my mom was first diagnosed, we experienced a lot of anger from her, a lot of paranoia and confusion. And she lived down in Yankton, South Dakota, and one night my dad woke up in the middle of the night and found the house empty. And she was gone. Turns out she had walked 3 miles on the highway in the middle of the night to sleep on the pew of her church. she knew exactly where she was, but didn't have an understanding of the context of safety and environment that was necessary to stay safe. And so when the staff at the church found her on the pew in the morning, they didn't know either because, as we know, there's a lot of stigma around Alzheimer's disease. And so my mom had chosen not to tell anyone. And for the first time, it was my dad's job to sort of share that secret the next morning when the church called her. And that was the moment when she came up and lived with me in Harrisburg for a while. And we found that Daybreak, the adult day program in Sioux Falls at Active Generations, was able to bring her in as a volunteer. They gave her a name tag and a place to hang her coat and welcomed her in. And she didn't have to acknowledge that she had the disease and they didn't have to talk to her about it. That was the first time that she received any sort of formal care. And very soon after that, her disease progressed. She moved to assisted living and memory care all within 6 months, I think.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Leslie, what kind of resources exist across South Dakota? What do you know about how the disparities between, you know, maybe rural and some of our bigger cities, what exists and where are the gaps?
Yeah. You know, obviously what is provided to folks in our bigger urban areas, there's just more there. There's adult day programs, there's support groups available. You know, there are memory cafes here in Rapid City and in Sioux Falls for the caregiver and the person living with, opportunities to be social a lot. It's a lot more robust in those bigger communities. It gets trickier when you're in the rural communities. You know, the association is, and other like-minded organizations work on trying to get support groups going. Sometimes the support groups aren't successful in the smaller communities because people don't like to come and share their information in smaller communities. Sometimes they're thriving. It depends. But we, you know, the association has a 24/7 helpline, which is so valuable to people, especially in states like ours, where someone is waiting to take your call in the middle of the night in crisis. I've had highway patrol officers call that number in South Dakota because they've encountered someone on the road. And I think that's something. I had someone just in the office a month ago, and she said, you know, I called that 24/7 number. I couldn't sleep one night, and I had this issue, and I called them. I just needed to talk to somebody. Our office is closed, and they were there. And she said they couldn't solve my problem, but they could give me peace enough that I could sleep that night. And sometimes that's what keeps you hanging on until the next day. And it doesn't matter what county you live in, that's always available. So I think anytime they can connect. I met with someone today. We talked about the power in just connecting with someone else who's gone through the journey, not a support group, just connecting for coffee and helping them realize this isn't so strange what you're enduring. I went through it too, and those kinds of things are really powerful.
What's a memory cafe?
It's a chance for the person living with the disease as well as their care partner to come and have a social time. So sometimes there's maybe a little program. They might do a craft. But Active Generation is holding those. And then there's also one in Rapid City as well that's being held. And just a really nice way for both folks to get a break and socialize.
Let's talk with our Sanford docs about treatment. We mentioned a little bit about maybe some things that are medication. But social activity, tell me a little bit, I'm not sure which one of you wants to take that first, but a little bit about how are we going to delay the progression? How are we going to treat this?
Right. And so, as I mentioned earlier, there's no definitive cure for Alzheimer's disease, but certainly we can offer symptomatic treatment. We can offer some medications that can, first of all, improve the memory, at least on the short foreseen future, and also provide, you know, social support, cognitive support for the patients who suffer memory impairment. One other point that I would like to add is, as we are, you know, providing treatments, I think the research is going to offer even more solid treatment that can even further slow down the progression of the disease for several years. I mean, we are talking the average life expectancy of patients with Alzheimer's disease about, you know, 8 to 10 years. I think that can certainly improve their quality of life. And as I mentioned, treatments like the anti-amyloid therapies can certainly be a very, very solid asset to delay the disease progression. So it is a medication component, and there is a social component. Social component by basically making, you know, memory-friendly environment, you know, for those who have neurodegenerative disorders, offer them helpful resources. And also I would like to focus on the caregiver, because I always say that the caregiver is the invisible hero, right? We certainly need to provide them with educational resources, make sure that they have financial and workplace protection as well, because this is, you know, the key element in improving the quality of life of Alzheimer's patients.
Along with treatments in slowing the progression, it's also important to identify other contributors of dementia. And what I mean by that is looking at medications, for instance. Oftentimes, I see my patients who come in and I review their medication list, and they are on multiple anticholinergic agents, which has known to be known to exacerbate dementia. And so these anticholinergic agents are implicated in accelerating cognitive impairment, delirium, falls, and fractures.
What are those for? What kind of conditions are those prescribed for?
So anticholinergic medications, for instance, what is one complaint that we all kind of talk about is sleep deprivation. You know, oftentimes our older adults have a hard time sleeping. And so they go to their local pharmacy and just go, find a drug over the counter, such as Tylenol PM, and they think that this medication is a safe medication because it's offered without a doctor's prescription. But this medication is very dangerous. It is, like I mentioned before, a potent anticholinergic agent that has been shown to accelerate cognitive impairment. And so it's simply identifying this medicine along with other medicines. For instance, those medicines that help or could help with overactive bladder are also known to be potent anticholinergic agents. So if you add these agents together, it can have amplified effects. And so medications, reviewing them is so important, along with identifying psychiatric diseases like depression, which can certainly accelerate memory impairment, metabolic disorders, identifying those, vitamin deficiencies such as B12. So it's also important to know that there are irreversible and reversible causes of dementia. And so focusing on those areas is important part of history taking.
I want to go back to the stigma that you mentioned, just at saying to your friends and neighbors, saying to yourself, saying amongst your family, why a stigma over it? Leslie, I feel like what have you heard from people that they say, like, no, this is really why I didn't want to tell people, because this is how my life changed after I told people?
There's so much. And I as much as I hate the stigma, I'd love to talk about this because I'm just always looking to break it down. And I think somebody that we saw years ago summed it up so well. His wife had been through cancer, and he said, you know, when she went through cancer, people brought casseroles and they showed up to help. And when she was diagnosed with this, they all disappeared. And there's so many people that I think feel that way, that their friends and neighbors. I think it's a lot of things. I think it's because it's uncomfortable. They get uncomfortable. They don't necessarily, the more we know, the more you're educated as a caregiver, as a friend, as a family member, you understand the disease better. And there are little things that you can do to make your experience easier when you're sitting across the table. But I think that's part of it. It makes people uncomfortable. They don't want to remember me. I don't want them to keep asking me the same question. I don't know how they're going to behave. What if he starts to eat the leaves and I'm sitting outside with, strange things that happen occasionally and that can be off-putting to people. And I think the other thing is that from the caregiver and the person living with, and definitely you can share your experience, but I think it's an old mindset of, I think they'll think I'm crazy. Awful. It's, 2025. But I think that's a big part of it. They're just afraid how people will perceive them if they go to church. Well, we don't go to church anymore because I don't want her to do something. And so what we're doing all the time, educating, going into communities and helping them better understand, and then those guards start coming down and people are starting to, you take it maybe a little easier, you know, and they learned how to react, and it starts to change that whole feeling.
People don't want to be pitied.
They don't want to be pitied.
Oh,
and again,
the poor dear, right. She thinks that this is,
sure.
Oh, isn't that sweet that she does? You don't want to be treated like a child.
Right.
Or an infant. Lisa, add to that.
Yeah.
What was your, talk about the stigma and your experience with it and how you dealt with it as a family.
Right. Stigma was strong. As I mentioned, my mom never shared that she had Alzheimer's with anyone. She made it clear to us that she wanted to appear well and healthy through her disease. And so we worked very hard to help her do that. She had some rough experiences very early on with a coffee group where the women would talk about her or ask her questions to sort of almost quiz her. Not intentionally, I think it's subconscious, but it was a hard thing to see her friends talking about her rather than showing up for her. And so we worked really hard to build her relationship with her already very present Red Hat Society friends. My mom was a queen mom, which if you know anything about that, it's a very big deal. And so we had tea parties. In fact, we hosted an Alzheimer's Association event that was a fundraiser where we had everyone dressed up in their red hat finest, and we had tea. And we just had to find the close people that felt safe. And like Leslie mentioned, nobody was bringing casseroles. Nobody was setting up a prayer chain. And I can't help but wonder how Alzheimer's could look different or look more similar to other conditions if that's how our society viewed it.
Yeah. How would you sustain that? What would you, because I think with cancer, there's this idea that there's a treatment cycle. You ring a bell, you're in remission. Maybe you get re-diagnosed. Maybe you're in hospice. There's some kind of path that mm-hmm. people acknowledge. With Alzheimer's, it feels like it's a deterioration.
Sure.
And there's never a breakthrough or an improvement. So if you were mapping out, if someone came to you and said, what can we do for this family beyond the first 2 weeks of casseroles, what does that look like?
Yeah. Well, I kind of have two perspectives on that.
Yeah.
One, I have a lot of hope related to treatments. The science is moving very quickly. We are learning a lot about a lot of different factors that influence not only Alzheimer's disease, but other neurodegenerative diseases. So I'm excited to see what comes. And I think down the road we will know, what does a risk profile look like for someone prior to symptoms? And we can start understanding better what their healthcare can look like throughout their adult life. And then secondarily, I think that there's an opportunity for us to change the way that we look at Alzheimer's or other neurodegenerative diseases in terms of this person brings so many joyful moments even now. I was thinking of the movie when the woman looked at the picture of herself, and she said, that was me, or it is me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my mom had a very similar view to that. Like, oh, she's beautiful. She used to look at herself in the mirror when she could no longer recognize herself in the mirror. And she would wave at herself and talk about how beautiful that woman was. And I thought, man, what a fantastic opportunity to find joy in this moment.
Yeah.
And that's how we can show up for each other.
Yeah. In this moment.
In this moment.
More after the break with our panel. You're in the moment on Listener Supported SDPB. Listening to In the Moment on SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Today we are previewing a new PBS Independent Lens documentary that airs tonight on SDPB TV. It is called Matter of Mind, My Alzheimer's. And we gathered a group of local Alzheimer's experts around the table in the Leo P. Flynn Gallery in SDPB's Sioux Falls studios to learn more about Alzheimer's research and what's happening for resources and helping families along the journey of Alzheimer's here in South Dakota. Our guests are Lisa Groon. She is a dementia care consultant and a caregiver. Leslie Morrow is State Executive Director of the South Dakota Alzheimer's Association. Dr. Alicia Hemraj is a geriatrician, an internal medicine provider at Sanford Health. And Dr. Ahmed Abdelazim is a neurologist at Sanford Health. Take a listen. There is a moment with that same family, Dr. Hemraj, where Andrea is helping her mother sort through some things, and mm-hmm. the mother says is telling an old story that she does remember. Remember when we went to the lake that time and we had that wonderful picnic? Andrea wasn't there. She couldn't come. And Andrea says, oh, I was there, Mom. Like, mm-hmm. I was there, thinking her mother had forgotten that she had been at the party. And her mother says, oh, no, my Andrea. And that's the moment when she disassociates herself for the first time as her daughter. And the daughter just, like, goes in the other room mm-hmm. and falls apart and mm-hmm. says, I don't know who I am if I am not my mother's daughter to my mother. Mm-hmm. What's happening in that moment in the brain when it gets to, and does it go back and forth mm-hmm. and back and forth? Or is that a benchmark? Because it certainly was a benchmark for Andrea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, Alzheimer's disease is such a dehumanizing disease. And, you know, early on in the progression of Alzheimer's disease, especially in the mild phase, these patients are aware, you know, and they're struggling with their awareness. And there'll be moments of clarity and there'll be moments of kind of ambiguity. And as this goes on, I think what I do to educate my caregivers is to not so much correct, you know, go with their flow is what I say, because they know during those times of clarity how painful it is. So I would recommend caregivers to just embrace and understand that this is a disease speaking. This is not the mom that I know. So I think having that in your mind, knowing that it's not purposeful, is so important.
Yeah. Also, there are some people in the film that get into activism. You know, they're on Capitol Hill in Sacramento asking for more diagnostic centers, asking for medication to be covered by insurance. Are there legislative priorities? Maybe we'll start with Leslie, or funding for research would be another thing. You know, federal funding or grants. Like, where are we at for some ways that we can move this conversation? Because more than seven million people, that feels unacceptable to me to sit and just watch that number go up. So, how has it changed with the political activism as Absolutely. You have your purple, color on tonight? Yeah.
I have been with the Alzheimer's Association. I just started my 12th year, and in that time, we've really seen things change from a public policy standpoint. Just on research funding alone, when I started, the government was funding NIH funding for Alzheimer's to the tune of about $770 million, million with an M, and we are now up over $3.2 billion with a B. And when you talk about the advances coming in lecanemab and donanemab and the treatments that are available, it is because of that investment. It is because, though, people take to Capitol Hill from all across the country and talk to their lawmakers and share their story and say, we are never going to figure this out until we start investing in it. So that's been a huge growth. The rallying that you talked about when those treatments first came out, when Aduhelm first came out, CMS wasn't covering it. So people took to rallying to say, for the first time in history, we have an FDA-approved treatment, and CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, are not covering it. Caused people to rally. It was effective. I think, you know, even locally, we have seen an investment in this. South Dakota Department of Health was awarded a BOLD grant, which is providing a roadmap for the state of South Dakota and is primarily focused on the Healthy Brain Initiative, early diagnosis, detection, but also then being in the trenches with caregivers. These are things that our state is doing. We, of course, are always bringing legislative priorities every year. So a lot is happening, and that is how you're really going to change the public health approach of this disease, helping many through that policy. So it's an incredibly hopeful time.
Yeah. Dr. Al-Azim, what would you add to the idea of, you know, what kind of investments need to happen? What do policymakers and lawmakers need to understand?
Definitely. I think we need to advocate for more research funds. We understand the pathology of the Alzheimer's disease, and we should take that advantage to improve our research to find, you know, therapies that can delay this disease or provide as long as possible a better quality of life. Another thing that I wanted to mention is we have to find more inclusive policy for care access for all the patients, especially in rural areas. Now we are in the era of telemedicine, for example. We can certainly improve that aspect and provide care, specialized care for several patients who are having a hard time driving long distances to go to larger medical centers. So there are certainly areas that we can improve in terms of providing more research funds and improve the care access for those who are in underserved areas, and also make sure that everyone has access to the state-of-the-art treatments that we are developing right now. So those are the most important thing that we need to work on.
Yeah, Dr. Hemraj?
Sure. There are, and I don't know if many people know this, but there are Alzheimer's Disease Research Centers. They're abbreviated ADRC. And these Alzheimer's Disease Research Centers, there's about 35 of them in the nation. And guess what? We have one very close to South Dakota, right next door in Minnesota at the Mayo Clinic. And so I encourage all those who are interested in clinical trials or even funding opportunities in the areas of treatment and early prevention to access the website or give the ADRC at Mayo Clinic a call and ask them, hey, what research opportunities or clinical trials exist today that I can be a part of or my caregiver can be a part of? Because we have to understand that there are patient dimensions and also care provider dimensions that we need to focus on.
Yeah. The Independent Lens filmmakers had given us a list of questions that they thought that we should all reflect on when we watch their film. And so we'll get to some questions from the audience here in a moment. But I thought we would look at some of these. And many of them we have kind of answered through the natural trajectory of our conversation tonight. But tempering the experience of loss for those around us. And that's maybe something we haven't talked about, just that grief and that loss of what your life as a caregiver was before you became, as the Janice says in the film, basically a single mother. I'm a full-time, people are leaving their jobs. They love their families. And at the very end of the film, you'll hear them say, like, I would not do it any other way. This is so important because I love this person. However, they have experienced so much loss in their own life, including for the patients, the loss of independence and the loss of awareness, the loss of a story. You know, it's not up here anymore. Where is it? That was my memory. Where did it go? Are there ways to temper that loss, Lisa?
I think it's important to understand that there are many little losses. And so the grieving looks different. One day, the story you were talking about a moment ago where her mom didn't recognize that she was her daughter. I had that exact same experience. And so that's a moment of loss. Like I said earlier, we challenged ourselves daily to find the joy in each day. And I don't want to imply that it wasn't hard and that there weren't a lot of loss and a lot of grieving. But really trying to find a moment of joy in those moments of sadness. My mom used to steal her next door neighbor's things from her room in memory care. And so we just decided she was thrifting and she's just doing a little rummage sailing, you know. And you don't get there right away, but helping to experience that loss in using a different lens, I guess.
Who did you talk to on your worst days?
Leslie. I had a group of daughters of Alzheimer's on Facebook that I spoke to quite frequently, and they were all about 40 years old, and we all had young mothers experiencing Alzheimer's, so we talked to each other quite a bit. I read a lot of books, and
And this has really changed, if I may, before Leslie. Your professional trajectory as well. Like, you have become more involved in your community, more active in politics, more open talking about these things. How this has been a transition for you into a new life as well.
It certainly has. When my mom was first diagnosed, I was working in the cancer in oncology, and a position opened at the Alzheimer's Association as the healthcare director, and so I moved my entire career based on Alzheimer's, and now I
regularly speak on the topic. So it's important that we, I think it's important that we share the stories, because the stories are what spur policy change and spur funding for research and so many other aspects of this.
And
care.
Somebody else going and getting tested, or you know, having a conversation around the kitchen table because they heard your story and they thought, oh, there is hope. It's not a death sentence. There are a lot of things I can do. I want to sit down with these doctors and tell them my personal story. What were you going to add, Leslie?
Just continuing on Lisa's thought, which is, someone shared with me once that nothing teaches you to live in the moment like caring for someone with dementia. And I think sometimes all you have is that moment, and that's where you find the joy, but you can't think down the road, or you can't think of what they have lost already. You know that right now I can hold my mom's hand, because at some point that day is going to come where you're not even going to be able to hold her hand. Or today I can walk outside with her. And I think it's really about breaking it down to the littlest things. But that's how you deal with the losses, is focusing on what you still have.
Yeah, the doctors are nodding their heads. What would you add, Dr. Elzey? That resonates with you.
No, absolutely. It's a life-changing diagnosis, having Alzheimer's disease. And although we know that eventually we are not going to be able to completely cure the disease, at least we can make the journey more joyful and improve the quality of life for those patients who suffer this progressive disease.
Yeah. We're going to ask some questions from the audience, but before we do that, is there anything that I didn't ask you that you wanted to make sure that you mentioned today for our radio listeners? We've covered a lot. We spent some nice time together, but is there one thing that you're like, hey, if you could take away one thing, I want you to take away this, Leslie.
Well, I always want to say this number, because I've talked a lot about that 24/7 helpline and then didn't provide the number. So 800-272-3900, but you can find it all over our website at alz.org and be connected with someone immediately who can help ease the journey a little bit.
Yeah.
Is there a genetic component that's known at this time in families where that might be a shared diagnosis from one generation to another, or across siblings with parents?
So as we know, Alzheimer's disease is mainly a disease of older adults, so primarily over the age of 65. There is a subset of these patients who have early onset, so before the age of 65, but not necessarily have a familial component. These patients account for maybe 5% of those diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. And then what you're referring to is the familial component, which is actually less than 1% of the patients who are diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. They do display some atypical cognitive changes and have certain genetic predispositions. And they can be certainly tested for these genetic mutations known as amyloid beta, presenilin 1, and presenilin 2. So these are some of the genetic mutations that can be tested in patients who have what we call the familial component of Alzheimer's disease.
Thank you so much to our panel of experts who are willing to come and talk with our audience about diagnosis and treatment and research and care for Alzheimer's in South Dakota. We invite you to watch the Independent Lens film, Matter of Mind, My Alzheimer's. It's on SDPB TV tonight at 9 Central, 8 Mountain. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ari Youngeman and Ellen Kester. Our executive producer is Kara Hetland. Our videographer is Jordan Henderson. From all of us here at SDPB, thanks for listening.